And it is time to open the thrift shop with DJ Frederick.
Told me goodbye. Can't you see? soul is always free. Silver's pages, golden curtains filled by head plate as could be. As a rainbow grew around the sun, all my stars of love and God came from somewhere beyond the sea to see. These lovely people played just for me. If I bid you see this place where stories all ring true, will you let me pass your face to see what's really you? It's not for me, I ask this question as though I were a king. Boy, you have to love, believe, and feel before the burst of tambourines take you there. Green grass and high clouds forever, castles of stone sold in glory. Lost faces say we adore you, as kings and queens bow and play for you.
And cold ancient shadows lost in time. still on the edge, hanging by a thread, waiting for a stranger's distant lights. In the darkness and the chill, all I've got is my own will to keep me moving through the night. Mountain road, on these mountain roads, on these mountain roads, on these mountain roads.
Well, I just had to play that tune. I'm playing that for Peter and the folks out at Pine Mountain Club, California, listening on Pine Cone Radio 100.9. That was Mountain Roads by Alan Watts. Before that, the Little River Band from Australia with Light of Day, the Outlaws, Green Grass and High Tides, and the Marshall Tucker Band, Can't You See and Can't You Hear? You're listening to the Radio Thrift Shop with DJ Frederick. Radio Thrift Shop rocks, folks, and jazzes things up, revving between 33, 45, and 78 RPMs. Well, I'm going to do another Drop the Needle segment this week, and here's how it works. Drop the Needle must involve something that I have never heard before, and it must have been purchased from a thrift shop. And I'm going to play at least 1 minute, no matter how terrible it is, but I can play more if I so choose. And today, I got at a thrift shop this week, really bizarre kind of generic album called A Tribute to Ken Griffin, Charles Rand at the Organ, released on Coronet Records, a division of Premier Albums, Inc. And what does it say? One of the most popular organists of all time is Ken Griffin, whose popularity extends back over 35 years. In the early 50s, Griffin created two smash hits, You Can't Be True, Dear, and The Cuckoo Waltz, and became, as a result, a national favorite. Well, you can't make this stuff up. This is really on the album liner notes. Griffin had his own TV show as well as many nightclub engagements prior to his untimely death. Charles Rand has recreated in this album the Griffin Golden Touch. For listening pleasure, the organ stands unsurpassed as the single instrument American music lovers like best, and this album is in that great tradition. So without further ado, I'm going to drop the needle on A Tribute to Ken Griffin Organ by Charles Rand.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm just going to say this reminds me of Corla Pandit, and anything that reminds me of Corla Pandit is not too bad, man. Okay, The Song of India by Charles Rand from the album Tribute to Ken Griffin Organ. And now I'm going to have to find out who Ken Griffin was. Wow, cool stuff. All right, I think it is time for a cowbell song.
Thank you. And as the years go by, true love will never die. At 17, this girl says, do you love me? And it really means, will you respect me? The teenage boy answers, I love you. And it really means, can I make love to you? And as the years go by,
Right, an unexpectedly mono version of the Talking Heads with the puzzling evidence. And I'm certainly puzzled as to why the turntable is playing in mono. Well, before that, Mosh McCann, and As the Years Go By, we started the set off with Argent, Hold Your Head Up. This is DJ Frederick. You're listening to the Radio Thrift Shop on WSCS 90.9 FM in New London. And this week, a very cool show is ending. It's only 90 seconds long, but it's been on non-commercial radio for, I would say, upwards of 20 years. It's called Earth Sky, and the show is all about our environment on Earth and also about what's happening in space and in the galaxies and in our universe. So I'm going to play a segment of Earth Sky.
Earth Sky.
The planet Mars has two moons. Jupiter has 66, Saturn 62, Uranus 27, and Neptune 13. But Earth has just one, doesn't it?
Moons are defined as Earth's natural satellites. They orbit around the Earth. Although Earth sometimes has more than one moon, some objects you might have heard called Earth's second moon aren't, really. Let's talk about a non-moon first.
You might have heard of the word quasi-satellite. A quasi-satellite orbits the Sun in the same amount of time as Earth, but the shape of the orbit is slightly different. The most famous quasi-satellite is 3753 Cruigne. This object is 5 kilometers, about 3 miles wide. It's not a second moon. Instead, it's an asteroid co-orbiting the Sun with Earth.
Also, Earth sometimes has temporary moons. In 2012, astronomers at Cornell University published the result of a computer study suggesting that Earth usually has a temporary moon, or mini-moon, as they called them. Mini-moons would follow complicated paths around Earth for a while, then break free and begin orbiting the Sun again.
An object discovered in 2006 appears to fit this description. 2006 RH120 was discovered in orbit around Earth, so it was a temporary second moon. But it began orbiting the Sun again 13 months later. For more, come to earthsky.org and search for the words Earth's second moon.
We're at earthsky.org.
All right, well, farewell, Earth Sky. You're going to be missed. That's a great, great, great informative show that is ending broadcast this week. I'll be playing more of Earth Sky, though, in weeks to come, kind of non-time-specific little segments. So please stay tuned. And now it's time for us to time travel back to the year 1901.
That was the year, recreating notable events of passing time, reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. That was the year. The festive Christmas and New Year holiday season had hardly waned until millions of Britons throughout the world came to the sudden, shocking realization that their beloved Queen Victoria was lying on a deathbed at Osborne House on the Isle of Wight, a palace replete with tender memories for the 82-year-old monarch. members of the House of Hanover had been summoned to attend the matriarch, and the two most conspicuous figures in the room were her eldest son, the Prince of Wales, soon to succeed his mother as Edward VII, and her eldest grandson, William II, Emperor of Germany. And so on January 22, the very anniversary of the death of her father, the Duke of Kent, at precisely 6:30 o'clock in the evening, Victoria Regina passed into the realm of the world's immortals in the 64th year of her reign.
19-1, that was the year.
Topeka, Kansas, February 5. Outside the ornate Senate saloon, about 4:30 in the morning, stand three women.
Got your hatchet, Carrie?
You bet I've got it. Come on, girls.
Carrie, there's a slot machine.
Yes, I see it.
Hey, lady, you can't do that. Hey, you quit that now.
Let me go. You can't lady. Stop me. I'm going to smash this joint until there isn't a vestige of it left. Oh. Come on, girls.
Hey, let's go. Help me. Help me. Help me.
Mrs. Carey Nation, nemesis of proprietors of so-called joints, soon found herself once more in the clutches of the law, but subsequently released on $100 bail. 3 days later, at a meeting of her followers...
Do you mean to tell me, Carey Nation, that you aren't going through with this raid?
No, I'm not. I'm tired. I'm going home.
You're a coward, Mrs. Nation. You're a coward.
No, I'm not a coward. I'll go this minute with any woman and smash her joint.
I'll go.
No, I've changed my mind. I'm tired. The law doesn't wish me to go out tonight.
The next day, Mrs. Nation recounted the meeting to newsmen.
Oh, it was beautiful to see how angry they were. It was a delicious half hour. I never was so happy in my life. I would rather die at the hands of those indignant women than saloon keepers.
Nineteen-one, that was the year.
Manila, Philippine Islands, March 8th.
Captain Hazard.
Sir.
Captain Newton.
Here.
Lieutenant Hazard.
Yes, sir.
Lieutenant Mitchell.
Yes, sir.
Now we're all ready. We have the forged letters from Aguinaldo's General Lasuna telling Aguinaldo that his brother is sending a company of his best soldiers. We are to pose as captives of Hilario Placido and his men. You understand, Hilario?
Si, senor.
Very well. Let's get aboard.
Yes, come on, boys, sir.
Thus did Brigadier General Frederick Funston of the U.S. Volunteers, four other American Army officers, and 78 sympathetic Filipinos embark on the U.S. gunboat Vicksburg to begin their adventurous attempt to capture Emilio Aguinaldo, insurrection leader. On March 14, the Vicksburg put out her lights, ran ashore 25 miles south of Casiguran, then began the arduous trek across 90 miles of rough country, swift rivers, precipitous mountains, dense jungles, lack of sufficient food and clean water, added to the difficulties. Finally, the courageous party arrived within 8 miles of Palanan, the village where Aguinaldo was purported to be hiding. Messengers were dispatched informing the rebel leader that the reinforcements promised by Insurgent General Lasuna had arrived, and that en route they had met American troops, had killed some and captured five. Aguinaldo sent food and the message that the American captives were to be treated kindly. On March 23, while his neatly uniformed personal guard stands in formation outside to greet the newcomers, Aguinaldo stands inside his makeshift headquarters, talking to his treasurer, Santiago Barcelona.
When these men arrive on the Argo, we will prepare for another attack. What is going on out there?
Maybe the men of your guard are celebrating the arrival of the reinforcements.
Fools! Stop that foolishness! Quit wasting ammunition!
Aguinaldo! Look out!
Emilio Aguinaldo! You are prisoner of the Americans.
No, no.
I will not be taken.
I stand.
Yes,
no.
No.
I will not be.
Throwing small statured Aguinaldo to the floor, corpulent Hilario Placido sat upon the insurgent leader until help arrived, and he was placed in the official custody of the American officers. At length, Aguinaldo resigned to his fate, acquiesced to peaceful captivity, and on board the Vicksburg made this statement.
Yes. Yes, I am beaten. I have no wish to die. I wish only to serve my people. I will swear my allegiance to the American flag.
And so ended a completely unexpected conflict, a war which had lasted six times as long as the Spanish-American War, which cost more than half as much, and which made an overnight hero of Brigadier General Frederick Funston.
19-1. That was the year.
Buffalo, New York, September 6. At about 4 p.m., President William McKinley, accompanied by his secretary, George B. Cotelliu, President of the Pan-American Exposition, John C. Milburn, and a group of Secret Service detectives enters the spacious Temple of Music, especially arranged so that he may greet and shake the hands of exposition visitors. A sudden disturbance at the door draws the attention of several of the presidential guard. Order is quickly restored, and then Secret Service agents Foster and Isla notice a man of swarthy complexion and slight stature approaching the president. A man's hand is bound in a handkerchief and rests partly inside his coat. One of the agents turns to the other.
That man has a sore hand.
Don't know about that, George.
Mr. President! Mr. Milburn, help me here.
Oh, this is...
Mr. McKinley, do you suffer much pain?
George.
Yes, sir?
My wife. Don't let her know about this. And if she does find out, don't let it be exaggerated.
Yes, sir.
What are they doing to that man? Boys, don't be too hard on him. Mr. Milburn.
Yes, Mr. President.
I'm sorry that this should have happened at the exposition. So sorry.
With three thoughts, for his wife, for his assassin, and for the harm the tragic event might have upon the success of the fair, William McKinley proved the most calm, a mighty oak among all present on that day. Upon receiving dispatches of the precarious condition of McKinley, Vice President Theodore Roosevelt and all but two of the cabinet officers rushed to Buffalo and directly to the Milburn home whence the president had been taken. That night, the first encouraging bulletin from attending physicians appeared.
The president is rallying and resting comfortably. At 10:35 p.m., the temperature was 104 tenths degrees. Pulse, 124. Respiration, 24.
Throughout the next days, the nation's citizens read with mounting relief the reassuring medical bulletins. But on the 13th, a new note of alarm appeared. Roosevelt, who had joined his family in the Adirondack Mountains, was warned to hold himself in readiness for an emergency. And when he reached North Creek, New York, he found officials of the railroad and the road's fastest train awaiting him, and a telegram from Secretary of State John Hay.
The president died at 2:15 o'clock this morning.
That afternoon, as high government officials gathered in the living room of the Ainsley Wilcox home, all with unashamed tears, John Hay faced Theodore Roosevelt.
Mr. Vice President, I've been requested on behalf of the cabinet of the late president to request, for reasons of weight affecting the affairs of government, that you should proceed to take the constitutional oath of office of President of the United States.
I shall take the oath at once in accordance with your request. And in this hour of deep and national bereavement, I wish to state that it shall be my aim to continue absolutely unbroken the policy of President McKinley for the peace and prosperity and honor of our beloved country.
Judge Hazel, please.
The Bible, Mr. Roosevelt. Do you solemnly swear that you will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of your ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States?
I so swear.
And thus began the vigorous, colorful administration of the man whose political enemies had sought to suppress his fervor by relegating him to the vice presidency. McKinley's assassin, Leon Czolgosz, whose only excuse for his act was that he was an anarchist, a disciple of Emma Goldman, was brought to speedy trial, executed at Auburn Prison, October 29.
19-1. That was the year
that this new song by Harry Von Tilzer first appeared to stir the heartthrobs of an English-speaking world.
The ballroom was filled with passion strong. It shone with a thousand lights. And there was a woman who passed along, the fairest of all the sights. A girl to her love.
And so, with the year 1901 sashaying off into the sunset, we now return you to your regularly scheduled thrift shop. That was Dennis Haywood from a privately released 45. It's When I Found You. This is DJ Frederick. You've been listening to the Radio Thrift Shop. I'd like to say thank you for listening. If you'd like to communicate with me, my email address is fmoe@colby-sawyer.edu. That's as in Frederick Michael Oscar Echo at colby-sawyer.edu. Closing down the thrift shop for this week. But remember, wherever you are on the planet, take good care of yourself, take good care of your community, and take good care of those you love.